picture this. You're standing in a dimly lit museum gallery. The air is cool. The floorboards are scuffed by, like, millions of footsteps over the
Right,
years.
that classic museum feel.
Exactly. And right in front of you, mounted on the wall, is a 350-year-old masterpiece. You lean in and you're staring at the way the light hits a pearl, or maybe the incredibly precise geometry of a tiled floor in a 17th century parlor.
It just draws you in.
It really does. And you just can't help but wonder, how did they actually do this? Like, was it just raw, unexplainable genius? Or is there some secret mechanical recipe hidden under those brushstrokes?
I mean, it really is the ultimate question of art history, isn't it? We look at the old masters, and their work feels almost like magic.
Yeah, totally.
Kind of defies our modern understanding of what human hands can achieve with just, a stretched canvas and some ground-up minerals. We all just want to peek behind the curtain.
Well, what if we didn't have to just wonder anymore? What if we could literally reverse engineer that genius? Because that is our mission for this deep dive.
And we have some incredible tools to do that today.
We really do. We are grabbing a stack of cutting-edge scientific research, and we are taking a, well, basically a forensic look at one of the most mysterious and famous artists in history, Johannes Vermeer.
It's so exciting.
Right. We aren't just doing an art history survey today. We are crossing 17th century oil paint with 21st century deep neural networks and computer-aided architectural design.
Yeah, the foundation of our investigation today rests on two incredibly detailed sources. First, we have a 2019 scientific review from the University of Amsterdam.
Such a good paper.
Oh, it's fascinating. It details a high-tech, totally non-invasive scanning project of Vermeer's most famous work, Girl with a Pearl Earring.
The big one.
The big one, exactly.
I'm psychic.
And second, we have a really fascinating architectural paper from the Universitat Politècnica de Catalunya.
And they took a totally different approach, right?
They did. Those researchers used CADSO, computer-aided design software, to solve a massive, I mean, decades-long controversy regarding another Vermeer painting, The Music Lesson.
So before we can really understand how Vermeer painted, I feel like we need to understand how we are looking at his paintings today.
Oh, absolutely. The methods have evolved so much.
Because the science of looking at art has just completely changed in a few decades. Let's start by going back a bit to the Mauritshuis Museum in The Hague. It's 1994, and they launched this massive project called Vermeer Illuminated.
Right. So in 1994, Girl with a Pearl Earring was slated for a major restoration. And to understand what they were dealing with, conservators and scientists had to get a physical understanding of the paint.
Which means what exactly?
That meant taking actual physical samples from the canvas.
Wait, I have to stop you right there. Are you saying they were like taking a scalpel and cutting pieces off a priceless Vermeer?
I know. It sounds completely terrifying to our modern ears, but we are talking about microscopic fragments here.
Okay, microscopic, but still, it's the real painting.
True, but they were very careful. They would find an area adjacent to an existing damage, like a crack, and carefully remove a tiny cross-section.
Okay, and what were they looking for?
The goal was to look at the stratigraphy under a microscope. And by stratigraphy, I mean the geological layers of the painting.
Oh, like layers of the earth.
Exactly. The base ground layer, the underpaint, the surface glazes, all stacked like a tiny layer cake. They also gathered what they call B samples.
What's a B sample?
Well, over the centuries, a glue paste lining had been applied to the painting back in the 19th century, and it caused the canvas to shrink.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
No, it caused the paint to lift at the edges of the cracks into these tiny bowl shapes, which is a condition conservators call cupping.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and sometimes microscopic fragments of paint had literally dislodged and just gotten stuck to the varnish on other parts of the canvas.
That still sounds incredibly nerve-wracking to me, just physically picking at it. But then let's fast forward a bit to 2018.
The completely different world.
Right. The museum launches a new project called The Girl in the Spotlight. And the rule this time is entirely different. It's non-invasive only.
Which is such a huge shift.
Nobody touches the physical surface of the painting. It makes me think of geology again.
How so?
Well, the 1994 method is like taking physical core samples of the earth, drilling down and pulling up a cylinder of dirt to see the layers. But the 2018 method is like flying a satellite overhead.
Oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, using advanced ground-penetrating radar to see all those layers down to the millimeter, but without ever actually picking up a shovel.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize the shift. The 2018 project brought an entire arsenal of non-invasive scanning technology.
It's like sci-fi stuff.
It really is.
Yeah.
But one of the most remarkable things about both the 1994 and the 2018 examinations is where they actually took place.
Right. They didn't just hide away.
Exactly. They didn't move the painting into some climate-controlled subterranean laboratory hidden from the world. They built a specialized glass enclosure right in the golden room of the Mauritshuis and did the work in front of the museum visitors.
In 2018, this temporary glass room was operating 24 hours a day for 2 weeks, right?
Yep. Completely visible to the public.
I can't fathom the stress of that. Why on earth would you do a delicate scientific procedure in front of a live audience?
It does seem crazy, doesn't it?
Doesn't that put immense unnecessary pressure on the scientists? I mean, you're firing high-tech scanners at one of the most famous faces in the world, and there is a crowd of tourists with their faces pressed against the glass watching your every move.
What's fascinating here is the cultural weight of this specific painting. Girl with a Pearl Earring isn't just another item in the inventory.
It's kind of the Mona Lisa of the North.
Exactly. It is the beating heart of the Mauritshuis collection. People travel from across the globe just to see her.
Yeah, you don't want to show up and find out she's in the basement.
The museum leadership realized that. They simply couldn't hide her away in a back room for weeks. It's just too important to the public.
So they leaned into it.
They made a really bold choice. They turned the scientific process into the exhibit itself. They set up screens and tablets outside the glass room, explaining the data feeds from the X-rays and 3D scanners in real time as the researchers were working.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the actual forensic work they did in that glass box is where the story gets really juicy.
It really does.
I want to talk about the mistakes they found. Specifically, there's a pretty scandalous error made in the 20th century that those early physical samples revealed.
Ah, yes. The Pett and Cofer mistake.
The Pett and Cofer mistake. Oh, sounds like a spy novel. What happened?
Well, when scientists examined those tiny physical cross-sections, they weren't just seeing Vermeer's paint. They were seeing a historical record of past restoration attempts.
Oh, like tree rings, but for bad decisions.
Pretty much. In 1915 and again in 1922, a restorer named Derricks de Wilde treated the painting to regenerate the upper layer of varnish, which had gone dull over time.
Okay, fairly standard so far.
But he used a trendy technique called the Pett and Cofer method. This involved exposing the surface of the painting to heavy alcohol vapor combined with a resinous substance called Copaiba balsam.
Now, I'm not a chemist, but pumping heavy alcohol vapor and balsam resin onto 17th century oil paint sounds like a massive recipe for disaster.
It is a terrible combination. We know now, with the benefit of modern chemistry, that Copaiba balsam softens and swells paint films.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it caused very specific, localized damage to one highly visible area of the painting. The bright highlight on the girl's forehead.
So it only messed up one specific spot?
Primarily, yes. If you look at the surrounding paint across the canvas, it's stiff. It has these raised, sharp cracks that come with natural aging.
Right, the stuff that makes it look old.
Exactly.
Oh.
But on that forehead highlight, the Pett and Cofer method caused the paint to soften so much that the cracks literally lost their sharp edges.
Yikes.
It became rounded. Then they filled up with a dark, murky residue from the varnish.
So it essentially melted the highlight.
In a microscopic way, yes.
But if you think that's wild, the scans revealed something even more shocking about the background. Like, when you picture Girl with a Pearl Earring, you picture her glowing face emerging from this dramatic void of flat, milky black.
That iconic dark background.
Right. But the research shows that wasn't Vermeer's intention at all.
Not even slightly. In 1994, and then confirmed with even greater microscopic detail in 2018, the scans proved that the background was originally painted as an even, smooth, glossy, translucent green.
A glossy green. I mean, that completely changes the vibe of the painting.
It really does.
It goes from this isolated, abstract darkness to, like, her standing in a lush, illuminated room. How does a glossy green background turn into a patchy, milky black?
Well, it comes down to the delicate chemistry of the pigments Vermeer chose. He was an absolute master of layering.
Okay.
He started with a very dark, opaque underlayer. The 1994 team initially thought this was just a simple bone black pigment.
Makes sense for a dark background.
But on top of that dark base, Vermeer applied a translucent glaze. This glaze was a mixture of a blue dye stuff called indigo and a yellow leg pigment called weld.
Okay, and the weld gives it that yellow color.
Yes, it gets its brilliant color from a molecule called luteolin.
Basic color theory, right. Mix blue and yellow, you get green. And the dark underlayer probably gave the green this rich, deep shadow effect. But what actually caused it to vanish?
So, The yellow lake pigment was made by attaching the organic yellow dye to an inorganic substrate of alumen chalk.
Alumen chalk. Okay, keep going.
Think of the alumen chalk as a microscopic colorless sponge, and the yellow dye is what soaked into it. Over 350 years, the alumen chalk stayed perfectly intact. But exposure to light and environmental moisture causes the fragile organic molecules. Hmm. So the indigo and the well dye to literally break down.
They just lose their color.
They fade away completely. So what we're left with today is that dark base layer showing through a patchy, faded glaze that has essentially lost all its tint.
So wait, we have the exact chemical recipe now. We know with absolute scientific certainty that the background was green.
We do.
So why wouldn't a modern restorer just fix it? Like, why didn't the 1994 team just mix up some indigo and weld and paint it green again so we can see what Vermeer actually painted?
I completely understand the impulse. It's so tempting. But doing that violates the core philosophy of modern art conservation.
How so?
Today, the absolute golden rule is to document, stabilize, and preserve. A restorer's job is not to invent or to fulfill some hypothetical idea of the artist's original intent.
Even if we know what the intent was.
Even then. Because if you paint a fresh layer of green over that background, you are covering up original 17th century material. You are permanently altering the historical object.
Ah, I see.
The faded background is part of the painting's journey through time. We use science to understand what it looked like, but we don't forge a new painting on top of the old one.
That makes a lot of sense. You don't want to rewrite history, even if history faded.
Exactly.
But that leads me to how they actually mapped all these invisible chemical layers in 2018 without touching the canvas. I mean, how do you process that much unseen data without just drowning in it?
That is where the 21st century data science really steals the show from the 17th century paint. The sheer computing power they brought into that classroom is staggering.
I read they used an instrument called MAXRF, macroscopic X-ray fluorescence.
Yes, MAXRF. Basically, it bounces X-rays off the canvas, and different elements emit unique fluorescence signatures back.
That is wild.
That is how they map the lead-white pigment in her eyes and in the pearl, literally atom by atom.
And the sources also mentioned MSOCT, multi-scale optical coherence tomography, which, from my understanding, uses near-infrared light to measure the depth of the layers.
Right, it's essentially acting like sonar for the translucent glazes. It lets them see the thickness of a layer without taking one of those physical cross-sections.
But the piece of tech that I just couldn't stop reading about was the Hyrox 3D digital microscope.
Oh, the Hyrox. The statistics on the Hyrox scan are just hard to wrap your head around.
Walk me through it.
So they place the painting flat on a specially built motorized stage. The microscope scanned the entire surface at 35 times magnification.
35 times for the whole thing.
The whole thing. It took 10 hours of continuous scanning, moving micrometer by micrometer, to capture 9,100 multifocus images.
Over 9,000 images. To give you an idea of the resolution, the final scan was 4.40 micrometers per pixel.
It's incredible.
You are looking at individual microscopic grains of pigment. But here is the massive headache I didn't even think about at first. A painting is not a perfectly flat, two-dimensional surface.
Not at all.
It has texture, it has warping, the canvas bows over time. So when you take thousands of pictures with different scientific cameras using different lenses and different wavelengths of light, you can't just lay them on top of each other like a digital sandwich.
Right, because they don't line up.
Exactly.
You're describing parallax errors and lens distortion. Every camera bends light slightly differently at the edges of its lens.
Right.
And because the painting has 3D topography, shifting the camera even a millimeter changes the physical perspective of a single paint clump.
So how did they fix that?
To solve this, the project brought in a brilliant data scientist named Robert Erdman. And he couldn't just use Photoshop to drag and drop these things.
No, I imagine not.
He deployed a deep neural network, LOSET, artificial intelligence. The neural network learned the precise mathematical curvature and distortion of every single scientific instrument used in that classroom.
That is so smart.
It then mapped the X-ray data, the infrared reflectography, and the 3D microscopic topography onto one massive unified spatial grid.
So it aligned everything with like subpixel accuracy.
Exactly. Erdman built this interface called a curtain viewer. Instead of trying to open a file that is hundreds of gigabytes large and instantly crashing your computer, this viewer lets researchers seamlessly drag a digital curtain across their screen.
I saw a video of this. It's so cool.
It really is. You just slide it to transition from the visible light image right to the X-ray to the infrared, all perfectly flawlessly aligned.
It is a total triumph of data science. It basically allows us to map exactly how Vermeer manipulated his paint layers today.
It's a game changer.
But here's where it gets really interesting. While we are using AI and deep neural networks to map Vermeer's paint today, the second source we have suggests that computers can also be used to solve a 350-year-old mystery about how Vermeer drew his initial sketches in the first place.
Oh, this is such a great pivot. We are jumping from the chemical layers of Girl with a Pearl Earring to the geometric foundation of another absolute masterpiece by Vermeer, The Music Lesson.
Such a beautiful painting.
And to understand the controversy here, we really need to talk about a documentary that sent shockwaves through the art world a few years ago called Tim's Vermeer.
Oh, this documentary is wild. So it follows this inventor named Tim Jennison. Now, Tim is not a trained painter at all, but he became totally obsessed with the theory that Vermeer must have used optical devices to achieve his hyper-realistic lighting and perspective.
Right, the idea that he wasn't just doing it by eye.
Exactly. So Tim used his resources to build a physical, life-size, meticulously accurate replica of the actual room depicted in The Music Lesson. He built the furniture, the windows, everything.
It's a staggering commitment to an idea.
Truly. Then, using a 3D CAD model to help him understand the layout and a clever mirror device, which is basically a variant of a 19th century tool called a camera lucida, Tim sat down and painted his own incredibly accurate version of The Music Lesson.
And Tim's experiment was a fantastic physical achievement. It really proved that the mirror technique works. But as the architectural paper from Miguel Eusendizaga so elegantly points out, there is a massive geometric anomaly when you compare Tim's final painting to Vermeer's original 17th century painting.
And the clue is literally hiding on the floor.
Yes, the checkerboard floor.
Okay, so when you look at the bottom left corner of Tim Jennison's CAD-based recreation, you see the middle of a dark tile. And in the very first horizontal row of tiles at the bottom of his canvas, there are two light-colored tiles.
Right, just two.
But if you look at that exact same bottom left corner in Vermeer's actual painting, you don't see the middle of a dark tile.
No, you don't.
You see a sharp diagonal line splitting a light tile and a dark tile. And Vermeer has three light tiles in his first row.
It is the most glaring structural difference between the two images once you know to look for it. You can't unsee it.
So, wait. Did Tim just measure the floor wrong when he built his physical replica? Like, did he use the wrong size tiles?
No. And that is what makes this architectural research so brilliant. The paper proves geometrically that the floor, the tiles, the wall, the windows in both paintings are absolutely identical in size and proportion.
So what's the difference?
The difference is the viewpoint. Yeah. The physical location of the observer's eye, basically where the camera is situated in the room, is fundamentally different in Vermeer's painting compared to Tim's computer-generated starting model.
Okay, explain that to me.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at how human beings naturally draw math versus how lenses physically capture light.
Right.
This architectural paper uses a method called Kato computer-aided deconstruction of perspectives. It's essentially writing perspective geometry in reverse.
Let's unpack that a bit. What happens when a human draws perspective?
Well, when human beings draw a perspective grid by hand, or when 3D CAD software generates a standard layout, they default to what is called a frontal perspective.
Like a classic one-point perspective.
Exactly. In a frontal perspective, the math is relatively easy for the human brain, or a standard algorithm, to process. The vanishing point for the transversal lines, so the horizontal lines going horizontally left to right across the floor, is located at infinity.
Meaning those horizontal lines stay perfectly flat and parallel to the horizon line on the canvas.
Yes. It's how we are all taught to draw a checkerboard floor in middle school art class. You draw the lines vanishing straight back into the distance, but the cross lines, they stay totally flat.
And that's exactly what Tim Jennison's CAD software did.
Exactly. But Vermeer's perspective is not a standard frontal perspective.
That's not.
No, it is almost frontal, but it is slightly imperceptibly askew. Mm. And when you use CAD software to deconstruct the angles of Vermeer's floor tiles and mathematically trace them back to their origin, you find the transversal vanishing point, what the paper calls point T.
And this is the jaw-dropping stat from the paper. Point T, the vanishing point for those horizontal lines in Vermeer's painting, is exactly 21.88 meters away from the central vanishing point.
21.88 meters.
Yeah.
Just let the physical reality of that distance sink in for a second.
Let me put that into perspective for you. If Vermeer wanted to draw that floor geometrically using the drafting tools of his day, so a pencil, a straight edge, and a piece of string, he couldn't just sit at an easel.
No, he could not.
He would have needed a physical workspace and a piece of paper over 22 meters long. He would have had to stretch a string across a room the size of a professional tennis court just to calculate the microscopic angle of one tile in a painting that is less than a meter wide.
Which is, of course, physically impossible for a canvas of this size in a cramped 17th century Dutch studio.
Right. He didn't have a tennis court in his house.
No. So this raises an important question. If Vermeer couldn't possibly construct this highly specific, slightly askew perspective using geometric math, how did he draw it with such terrifying accuracy?
The KDOP analysis provides the smoking gun here. He didn't construct it with math at all.
Nope.
He traced it. The perspective grid in the music lesson is exactly the mathematical distortion you get when you use a booth-type camera obscura equipped with lenses.
Precisely. A camera obscura is basically a dark room or an enclosed booth with a small hole or a glass lens in one wall.
Sort of like a pinhole camera.
Exactly. Light from the brightly lit room outside shines through the lens and projects an inverted, live, moving image of the scene onto the opposite wall inside the dark booth.
Okay, and why does that explain the 22 meters?
Because a lens doesn't care about the shortcuts of human drawing.
Mm.
And because the lens was positioned just slightly off-center to the room, it projected an image where the transversal vanishing point was pushed 22 meters away.
It just captured reality as it was.
Exactly. So Vermeer had to have sat inside that dark enclosed booth looking at the projected image of that room. He marked the extreme points of the projected lines, connected them with a straight edge, and that became the scaffolding for his entire painting.
I have to play devil's advocate here because I feel like this is where art purists get really upset.
Like they do.
Does knowing this ruin the magic? Like, no. Does knowing that Vermeer essentially sat sweating in a dark wooden box and traced a light projection make him a cheat? Is he less of a genius because he used a machine to draw his floor?
Absolutely not. And the architectural paper is very firm and passionate on this point. Constructing a geometric perspective is just technical drawing. It's drafting.
Right. It's just math.
Exactly. Anyone with the right tools, a long enough piece of string, and enough patience can map out a grid. But the perspective grid is just the bare scaffolding of a house.
It's not the house itself.
Right. The way the light softly diffuses across the plaster wall,
mm-hmm.
The heavy folds of the fabric, the subtle mixing of an indigo and weld green glaze in a shadow, the absolute soul and atmosphere of the painting. No optical device, no lens, no camera obscura can do that for you.
The machine can't paint.
Exactly. Tracing the projection just saved him from having to build a 22-meter drawing board.
Mm.
The brushwork, the manipulation of the paint itself. That is where the untouchable genius lives.
So what does this all mean? We started by standing in a gallery, looking at a masterpiece, wondering how it was made. And the answers we found by digging through these scientific papers are just incredibly poetic.
They really are.
We used 21st century deep neural networks and X-ray fluorescence to look through the ages and discover faded 17th century glazes. And then we used modern CAD software to run geometry in reverse, mapping an impossible 22-meter vanishing point that proves these revered old masters were actually using the high-tech optical gadgets of their own day.
They were the tech nerds of the 1600s, pushing the boundaries of what tools could achieve.
Exactly.
It is a profound realization, and it bridges the gap between science and art beautifully. And it leaves us with something really compelling to think about as we look toward the future.
What's that?
Well, if modern science reveals that the revered old masters use mechanical optical devices like the camera obscura to achieve their masterpieces, devices that were essentially the absolute cutting-edge technology of their era.
Right.
How will the art historians of the 25th century view the artists of today? When future technologies peer back at our time, will the use of digital tools, tablets, and even generative AI be seen as a cheat code? Or will it simply be recognized as our era's camera obscura? Just another technological lens through which human genius found a new way to express itself.
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant question to end on. The next time you find yourself standing in a gallery staring at a masterpiece, just remember that the magic isn't in the absence of tools. The magic is in what the human hand chooses to do with them. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning what you see, and we'll catch you next time.